Hello, Shai.
Hi.
I'm really stoked to have the opportunity to talk to you. I have to tell you that when your CD crossed my desk, I just fell in love with it. Musical fantasy is really just an amazing outpouring of, I think, different feelings that you had. And in fact, it says that right on your webpage. I love that. Music is what feelings sound like. And I totally got that with every piece on this CD.
Well, thank you. It was a very personal CD, and it was a chance to sort of do what I do unfiltered. I work mostly in film and TV, so usually what I do is, for a very specific purpose. It's like the scene needs to be supported with something dark or sad or happy or scary or action driven or, whatever the film needs. It's about the film, which is great because it's instant inspiration. You don't have to wait for something to come to you. You just, the project informs you of what you need to do, and you just try to find a creative way to do it. This was just sort of, this is what comes out of me when I just get to do whatever I want. So in that regard, it's a lot more personal. And it's also a lot more scary to do.
That was actually one of the questions I was wanting to ask you about. It seems like, for anyone when they're writing a piece, whether it's a commissioned work or, as you were just describing, where you're constrained a little bit by, hey, this is what's going on, so we need some action music, or it's going to take a darker turn, so we need mood music. This is completely, as you said, to borrow your word, you unfiltered. And I think personal work, clearly, each piece, again, I felt not only does music describe what feelings sound like, but you also were really telling a story with each of these separate pieces. And I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to kind of get into that a little bit, but I kind of wanted to start off with your biography just really caught my attention, having been someone who was sat down also on a piano bench at the age of three, and there was no chance for me to ever opt out until I graduated from high school and became, quote unquote, an adult. I love the fact that you were really kind of a rebel about this. Your parents started you in piano lessons, but you sort of went rogue on them a little bit.
Well, rebel is a very kind word. I would say more difficult child.
I mean, the musical gifts were clearly there. What was it that was so difficult to kind of reconcile for yourself with having to sit down and learn notes and music and theory?
I'm not sure. I mean, I was 5 and 6 at the time, so it was about 5,000 years ago. But I think just, I mean, generally, I hated school. I hated being told what to do. I hated having to, to conform to whatever it was I was told I needed to do. So I think I was the kind of kid that, like, if I wanted candy and somebody said, "You must have candy," I would immediately flip to, "I don't want candy." And I think that was just me. I was just like, "You don't get to tell me what I want. You don't get to tell me what to do. I just want to do my own thing," which I think drove my poor parents crazy because when you're a small child, and now I have two of my own, so I'm somewhat familiar with it from the other side. When they don't want to do what you need them to do, the go-to sort of thing, when it gets to the, like, when it gets escalated enough, the go-to response is, "Let me show you what a tantrum looks like," which every parent knows. But it's like with my kids who are awesome, I get that every once in a while when it's like, oh, wow, okay, you must really not want to do this. And I think when I was a kid, it was sort of like my first go-to place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I just didn't like the idea of being told what to do. I think I was very independent for whatever reasons. I think I still am, and I try to instill that in my kids, too, who are, to both my great delight and chagrin when it kind of makes my life harder. But
don't you think that's great, though, when your parents must have probably or possibly sensed that you had some kind of an inner confidence about your abilities and what you were doing? Because I think as parents, we all have to, you know, strive for that balance between not completely enveloping our kids in what it is that we think they should do and where they should go, and letting them be that person that's free to express themselves and to utilize their gifts in the fullest way possible.
Well, I'm not sure if it was confidence. I think it was more just stubbornness. And I'm still not confident that I'm any good at this. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I still feel like I'm just starting out, and hopefully one day I'll get good enough to be acceptable. So I'm not sure how much confidence there is, but there is this sort of fake it till you make it kind of a thing, which I think is true for a lot of us too. I think the self-doubt is probably healthy and good because it pushes you.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, having been in this, you know, doing music for a living for 20 years now, I guess there is some confidence. I mean, I know who I am and what I can and can't do, you know, where my strengths, where my weaknesses are. And I've come to accept, like, who I am as I am. So not all my clients are going to like me. Not everybody's going to like my music. Not everybody's going to like me personally. And that's okay. And at the same time, it's also devastating when somebody doesn't. But it's also okay. You know, it's like, it sucks, but not everybody's going to like you. What are you going to do? You know, I mean, what's wrong with them that they don't like me? I mean, what's wrong with me? I mean, I don't like that they don't like me, but at the end of the day, but this is who I am. And I've come to be, you know, sort of be comfortable in my own skin and just accept this is how it is. So
I think that has to be a real leap of faith to write something as personal as these pieces on Musical Fantasy. I mean, you're talking about, you know, really putting a lot of yourself into these pieces. Not that you don't with the other music that you write, but again, that's different. This is music that's written for a specific purpose. These were your pieces. These were personal pieces. They were telling stories. And I think that, too, is kind of a real leap of faith and does show a little bit of confidence that you've got something to say and you're going to be bold enough to put it out there for people to listen to and relate to.
You know what? I don't think I had a choice.
Really? How so?
I don't know how to explain it any better than it's like breathing, or it's like I could hold my breath only so long, meaning have these things in me and not get them out.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, you have to take the next breath. You have to, or it's an itch that you just have to scratch. You know, it's like I don't see it as a choice. It just had to happen. I had to do it, and I had to get it out, and. It's some of these pieces I had previously, some of them I wrote once I decided I'm doing this and doing the album, but I literally got to this place of I have to scratch this itch or it'll drive me crazy. I just have to get it out. So that isn't so brave necessarily or so much of a choice, more as it's something I just needed to do for me. I don't know how else to explain it.
No, I think that's beautiful. And, you know, it was something I kind of wondered about, especially when I was listening to them. I know there's other composers working in film and television. Two spring to mind, John Barry and Danny Elfman, that also released collections of music that were completely independent from any film project or television work. And I often wondered if that's what it was for them too. There was just this music there that had to be written. It had to come out. So I feel now like you've given me a little confirmation on that.
Well, I don't know about John Barry, but I've worked with Danny Elfman for the last 15 years, and I co-produced his Serenata Schizophrenia. And we worked on that on
awesome CD
for over a year. I'm credited as co-producer on it. And I think that was for him also something that he just needed to get it out. It is just one of the things I really admire about Danny and composers like him. And this is whether you like their music, don't like their music, like how they work, don't like their, just independent of anything that has to do with who they are as a person, he's always pushing himself. You know, he's always trying other things. His attitude, you know, he does these huge movies and some of the biggest blockbusters in the history of Hollywood. And then he goes, does these little films because there's a chance to push himself creatively, or he writes Serenata, or he does his ballet, or, you know, all these other things. And I love that he's always pushing himself, and I find that very admirable. So I guess maybe part of me like looks at somebody like that and says, that's really cool that they push themselves. And I see I have to do the same for myself.
Oh, yeah. And it came together so amazingly well.
Thank you.
I know. I apologize if I sound like I'm gushing overly, but this was a CD that, honestly, I get a lot of them and I audition them. And yours captured me from the very first piece. And I found myself actually auditioning all the way through the CD. So it was like I had to listen and then listen to the next story and the next story and the next story. And, you know, when you write on your webpage about music is what feelings sound like, you know, that's one of the most important things, I think, that music does for us is it expresses that full spectrum of emotions when words fail us. So I think it's really important, especially in these kind of uncertain times, to hear music from composers who are alive and writing music right now that sort of speaks to the full spectrum of human emotions that we're all trying to work through and process ourselves as our chapter in history is unfolding right now. And the first story on your CD actually does that. It's a really beautiful and very profoundly moving reminder of a very unhappy event in history. And as this generation of people that went through this particular period of time are now passing away, I think it's important to remember their stories. And that's the Fantasia Appassionata. Where did that fall? It's the first one on your CD. Was that the first piece that you wrote?
I'm not sure chronologically if that was the first piece that I wrote, but when I wrote it, that was one of those things that just suddenly hit me. I think I was working and I took a little break, and I was on Facebook or something and I saw a link to this video about this amazing centenarian named Alice Hertz Sommer, who was this pianist, and she was at the time the oldest living Holocaust survivor, and she got through the concentration camps because she was a professional pianist, and the Nazis would often take musicians and force them to play concerts and entertain troops and for propaganda. So when Red Cross would come to make sure that
everything's on the up and up, which obviously it wasn't. They'd put up these concerts and, you know, do this whole show so that it looked like prisoners were treated fairly.
And humanely, yeah.
And she was one of those musicians. And if I remember correctly, she lost her husband in the concentration camps. And, you know, she went through some awful, awful times that are unimaginable, like so many others. Yet here was this short video talking about a documentary of this just cheerful, lovely, delightful, full of life, full of love woman who still plays the piano every single day. And just, it grabbed me in such a way. And, you know, the video was a few minutes long and I watched it and it ended. And I remember just kind of sitting there in almost in shock for a few minutes at just how powerful it was to hear this woman's story. And instead of getting back to work, I had this idea in my head. So I'm like, all right, I'll quickly sketch it out. I'll spend 5-10 minutes to just put down a couple of things and then I'll get back to work. And at about 4 a.m, I kind of realized it's been more than a few minutes. but the whole thing was done. I mean, it just spilled out of me. I don't think I'd ever written so much so fast. It just completely spilled out of me. And it's just me imagining, you know, the idea was to come up with this beautiful theme to represent her and, you know, a sweet life and things are good before the war. And then as the war comes and the horrors of what she had to endure, yet hints of that theme never go away. You know, it's like her spirit was never broken. So even when it's more harsh, I never get too dissonant. It's always still very tonal, and because she never broke,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
And then after the war, despite the devastation, despite everything, she's still her. She's still this beautiful soul. So I get back to the theme, but treat it a little bit differently and give it some counter lines and things that weren't there before. And it just came out, and pretty much that was it. I think I didn't touch it or change it until I started working with my pianist, Rob, Robert Thies, who's amazing. We tweaked a couple of things. I think I changed maybe 5 or 10 notes. I mean, it was very, very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But that piece is like 99.9%. That's just what spilled out of me after watching that short film about her. It literally was just, this is what I felt.
Well, it was an amazingly powerful piece. Like I said, it grabbed me and didn't let go. In fact, I think I listened to it a couple more times and then moved on to your other pieces, because it captured all of that in there. When you're talking about her story, that was one of the things I kept thinking of, was what would that be like for a musician to have something that they love and a gift that they give to the world and then be forced to do it under unimaginably horrible circumstances like that. Would it break you? Would it take away your ability to love what you do? Would it change your feelings toward the gift that you had to bring music into the world and the responsibility that you have to use those gifts for the betterment of the world? And you answered all of that beautifully in that piece, in that, yeah, it never happened. And you really shade it beautifully in the middle, where things start to take that very dark turn, and then there is beautiful reconciliation at the end. It's not the same, but then none of us are the same after those kind of life-changing events.
Well, thank you. I mean, I remember at one point when working with Rob, there was a section, and he goes, "Now, are you sure about this? It gets really, really muddy down here, because everything is very low on the keyboard, and pretty close together, which makes for, you know, not the most clarity necessarily. It makes for very dark, mm-hmm. kind of muddy tones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my response was, in my smart alecky way, was something along the lines of, have you seen footage of what the concentration camps look like? yes, it's supposed to be very muddy, and you know, it's like.
Oh, I thought it worked. It was very visceral.
And it's supposed to not be completely clear necessarily, and a little bit messy because it was. And I think, you know, I grew up. My grandfather survived the war. And I'm originally from Israel, so I grew up knowing a lot of people who survived the Holocaust and personally lived through it. And I've heard a lot of firsthand accounts. You know, it's we had a nanny that would come and watch us every once in a while, who survived Auschwitz. She had a number tattooed on her arm. So I grew up with this. You know, the Holocaust to me isn't just history books and documentary footage. It's personal stories. So mm-hmm. I think that probably made its way into there. Mm-hmm. You know, just that it's very visceral for me, and I don't pretend to know what it felt like or what it was like. I didn't live it. I didn't endure it or anything even close to it. But still, when you hear firsthand accounts about what people went through, it's different than watching a documentary, you know?
Yes.
Or reading about it. It affects you differently. You know, I had a huge extended family that I never got to meet because they were murdered long before I was born. You know, I think my grandparents, between the two of them, had something like 12 or 13 siblings in total, and only four survived the war. You know, my grandmother and her brother and my grandfather and his brother were the only ones to survive the war, and they all had big families. They both had big families. So that's personal. Even though I never knew them, I never met mm-hmm. them because they died, you know, long before I was born. There's still this feeling of something's missing, you know, and so I think that probably affected why that story touched me and how the music came out. You know, I was probably interjecting some of my own feelings about it as well.
Sure. Well, I just love how you're not only telling her story, but you're telling the story of your family members and the story of millions, actually. It's always a good reminder, I think, through music of events in history that we should not forget. And you tell a lot of personal stories on this whole album. The other piece that really resonated with me was Esme's Moon. I also had a teenage daughter that passed away, under the same circumstances as the young lady for whom this is about. But I think that's why this piece really grabbed hold and didn't let go. It resonated very powerfully with me. And I love the fact that you're telling the story of who this young lady was.
Well, that was a hard one.
I can't even imagine.
Interestingly, that piece kind of has a weird evolution, I guess. Originally, that was a theme that I wrote based on a script to the first feature film I ever scored.
Really? Wow.
And I wrote it, and the story of the film was a story about a woman coping with the loss of her husband. And so, you know, it was a story about grief, obviously, mm-hmm. and loss, but also life and... you know, when I look at grief or at loss, a lot of people go, well, it's so sad and dark and difficult. But I think, strange as this may sound, there's a lot of beauty there, because if you didn't passionately love the person that you lost, you wouldn't be feeling grief. So the grief comes from love and from all the beauty that is gone you know, so it makes me think of all of those things, which are beautiful and positive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this pretty theme that ended up never getting used because I wrote it, like I said, based on the script. And once the film was done, it just didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow that melody always kind of stuck with me. There's something about it. And I got to do something with this one day.
Uh-huh.
And originally it was written for an orchestra.
Oh, my. Wow.
And then right around the time when I was doing some stuff on the album, I was doing some technical work. I was getting into, I switched the sequencing software that I was using and stuff. So I was setting up a new template. And I thought, you know, what better way to test drive my template than to write a piece that really uses the main thing. So I'm like, I'm just going to do a version of this thing. And I wrote it for piano and orchestra. And a lot of the, you know, all that fast sort of frills and stuff came not from a place of, hey, let's do something really amazing, but it's from, I need to practice using the software and doing more challenging things, you know, for my own, you know, just to get things up and running and get used to the new software and stuff. So it was more, I was trying to do that. And while I was working on it, I heard about Esme's passing. And I know Esme's dad. I never met Esme herself. But I went to the memorial service, and during the service, which was in their backyard, they had, I don't know, maybe 100 photographs of her from throughout her life. And I walked around and I saw pictures, you know, snapshots of a childhood. And it was just this beautiful, happy, vibrant, sweet, creative child. And then I heard stories, and eventually her mom spoke. And she said this beautiful story about how when, I guess, Esme was a kid, she liked to kiss everything and everyone. And so she would go around and she's like, you know, can I kiss this? Can I kiss that? Can I kiss this person? Can I kiss that person? Whatever. And one day, I think she said it was a full moon or something like that, and she looked at the moon and she says, Mom, can I kiss the moon? And it really touched me. And I was like, what a beautiful soul. What a beautiful child. And I went home and I was thinking about her, and this piece just suddenly screamed that it belongs to her. And knowing I'm working on the album, I was like, you know what? I'm going to turn this into a solo piano piece and dedicate it to her. So I called her dad and I asked him if that would be okay, because I didn't want to do anything that he, you know, that would be too painful or hard or upsetting to them. And he gave his blessing. And so I got to work on changing it from an orchestral piece to a solo piano piece, which is a completely different type of writing, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And you noted that you worked with Robert almost continuously on this one too.
I'm not a pianist, so thanks to the magic of technology, I can make anything happen. But there's a big difference between having a computer play it
and the mechanics, yeah, of the person.
So I took what I wrote and I went over to Rob, who lives not too far from me, which is very convenient to have one of the world's best pianists, you know, be one of your best friends and live 15 minutes away. It's very kind gifts of the universe to give me. So I went over to his house with the piece and kind of, I said, okay, here's what I came up with. And let's start working on it and making sure that it sits comfortably in the hand and things like that. So he started playing with it and we would see, you know, where he's struggling with fingerings or where there was fatigue or ear fatigue, because I just had, you know, to quote the famous line from Amadeus, too many notes. So like, because once I got started with the 16th notes, I never stopped. I was like, here we go. Boom. knowing that I was going to rework it. And again, on a computer, the computer will play it till the cows come home. And also the computer, even with the best samples, they just don't have the same resonance of the real instrument. And especially since I'm not a player and I'm a lot of it, I'm programming in literally one note at a time. You can do what's called step programming in a sequencer where you can say any note I play will now be a 16th note and it'll just play the next 16th note and the next 16th note and the next 16th note or whatever whatever I tell it to be, an eighth note, a whole note, whatever. So I can literally, instead of going and having to be able to play it, I can literally go ta ga ta ga ta ga ta ta at that tempo or however I want, and then I hit play and it plays it at the correct speed. So you lose some of the feeling and the emotion. So once he played it live, I was like, okay, there's too much stuff here. Let's take some of this out. Let's change some of this. Let's let it breathe a little bit more. There are a few little things where he's just like, he kept tripping up on something. And I was like, well, let's change the voicing and make it more fluid and more comfortable to play. And so he did a lot of work to help me figure that out and made a lot of suggestions, some of which I was like, this is awesome. And they're in there. And some of them I went, you don't like what I did, but I don't like what you're suggesting. So what else we got? And we just worked it and worked it until it was there, you know. And well, I have to say, it's the first time I've gotten to actually work like that, and it was really, really cool.
Well, it turned out really, really beautifully, let me tell you. It just, you captured all of the beauty, I think, and the innocence of childhood and of a person that was on the cusp of being able to give the gifts they had to the world, but circumstances dictated that was not to be. So I think it is just a beautiful little piece. And again, that was one that really was close to my heart, along with the Fantasia Appassionata. You have Old Friends, which obviously listening to that was very evident. You know, this is old friends getting together, working together, swapping memories, kind of that nostalgic look back. And Ananke, was also dedicated to a friend of yours, a horn player, who also was undergoing some very serious medical circumstances at the time and was still able to come and play this piece for you. And you make mention in your notes that this was one of his final performances was on this recording. What a gift.
We didn't know it at the time, but this is his final recording. Brian is an incredible, or was an incredible, session player. If you've watched movies in the last 30 years, you've heard him play because he's played on thousands of films.
Brian O'Connor.
Yes, he used to play for Jerry Goldsmith, and if you're a Star Trek fan, then you know the great horn solos in First Contact. That's Brian.
That's him.
that's him. And he's just played on so many iconic scores and things, and I've been lucky to work with him over the years. And he was great because we could hang out on the 10-minute breaks during sessions or after sessions, or if we'd meet at union meetings or wherever, and always talking music and always passionate. And he was such a giving guy. And I kept saying, one day I'm going to write something for you. And he said, well, then one day I'm going to play it. And when I did this album, I called him up and I said, hey, I'm doing this album and I know you've been struggling. He had brain cancer. I think he had two or three surgeries. He sort of had it, had surgery, come back to playing. Then a few years later, it came back again. I think this was the third or fourth time of him dealing with it. And I said, you know, are you interested? Are you up for it? And he just immediately said, yes, let's do it. So I wrote the piece for him. Again, went to him with the piece, showed him the first draft, got some notes from him, did a few tweaks, kind of went back and forth a couple of times. Same thing with Rob on the piano parts. Because one of the things that I wanted to make sure is that it's not, like the piano isn't just accompaniment. I wanted it to be a piece for both.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I hate the idea of accompanist.
Yes.
It's like, no.
You each both, have a part that's important.
You're both phenomenal musicians. And yeah, no part should be secondary to another for me on something like this. And then when we went into the studio to record it, it was evident that Brian was struggling and that his health wasn't that great. I didn't know how bad. I didn't know that 2 weeks later he was going to have his final surgery and that it turned out that that was the last time he played professionally or recorded. I think it may have been the last time he played, period, because I know,
wow.
Like I said, about 2 weeks later he had surgery. And, you know, like 4 months later, he was gone. So, and that I didn't know at the time because Brian didn't share that. He didn't share how bad it was.
Mm-hmm. He may not have wanted that to get in the way of what was being created, do you think?
I think Brian was just a very positive guy, and his thing was like, this is my problem, not yours. I really think it was as simple as that. I think it's just, he was never a complainer. He was just Mr. Positive, Mr. Nice. He was like, this is about the music. This is not about me. Let's just, you know, and no excuses. He was also that kind of guy. He's like, you know, if I'm dealing with a health issue, that's my problem, you know, not yours. Let's make this happen. Let's make it good. He was just the consummate professional, not to mention a great guy. So that was a lot of fun for me to work on. And then after the fact, to realize that that was his last piece, makes it a lot more even more personal. Like before, it was just something that two friends are doing and cool and fun and personal in that way.
Totally.
But now to realize that that was the last thing he got to do, you know, makes it even more special.
Yeah, I love that. One final gift to the world. It's just, I think we all hope that that's how we can leave the world, with something better and as a great testament to what we tried to achieve throughout our lifetime. I just thought that was really poignant. Well, Shai, you've had such a great career here. You have a couple of exciting things coming up, I believe.
Well, I am working right now. I'm a music editor on a couple of TV shows. I'm working with Blake Neely on Arrow for the CW, which is in its fifth season. I'm working on one of my favorite shows because it's a show that my kids like to watch. It's a children's show on Amazon Prime called Just Add Magic. And the second season actually just became available today. And I'm the music editor and music supervisor on that one. And I am also currently scoring, writing the music for John Singleton's new series that's going to be on BET called Rebel, which is very exciting. And getting to actually score my own TV show is pretty exciting. And I've been hired to do the first couple of episodes so far, and I'm hoping that that leads to doing the rest of the series.
Well, Shai, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to really talk in depth with me about your release, Musical Fantasy, which came out in May of last year. It's really an amazing series of stories and, again, journeys. And you really give a lot of feeling and a lot of personal touches along the way, but leave it completely open for other people to sort of interpret how they like. And I think that's probably one of the greatest things that a composer can actually do is not only write this music, but write it in such a way that it speaks to other people, whether it speaks in the same way or in a completely different way. And I think you've achieved that beautifully with Musical Fantasy.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it and that it spoke to you. Ultimately, that's what one hopes for. So I'm glad it succeeded.
Thank you, Shai. Thanks for your time.